Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
Today, we're delighted to have two Montana writers in the studio with us, John Clayton and Gary Ferguson, who are not only prolific writers, but they're good friends from the Red Lodge area.
John Clayton's new book is titled Wonder Landscape, Yellowstone National Park, and the Evolution of an American Cultural Icon. It's a fascinating cultural history of both Yellowstone Park itself and of what Americans wanted and needed as a country when the park was first formed and how that has continued to evolve.
Gary Ferguson has written more than 20 nonfiction books on nature and science, including Hawk's Rest and The Carry Home. As a nature writer, his books focus on the issues of ecology and conservation, with a particular focus on how people interact with nature. His new book is Land on Fire. Thanks, guys, for being here.
It's a pleasure to be
with
you.
What a delight.
And Gary, I accused you of finding a great publisher. I mean, you didn't start those fires, but there can't be a more timely book.
Yes, thank you for making that very clear, Corby. I did not start those fires. No, they were plentiful this year.
You've said that while there's always been occasional big fires, they've gotten much, much bigger and more common since 2000. Can you explain why so?
Well, it's a bit of a perfect storm that's going on. One of the things is we're still harvesting the consequences of being overly aggressive beginning in the early 20th century for about 80 years with putting out every fire. And the fact of the matter is the western forests and all the creatures that live there have evolved over thousands of years with fire. Fire is a healthy thing. The so-called normal fires, stand maintenance fires, clear the diseases and the pathogens from the forest, and they clear the debris from the forest floor, the fallen trees. In an arid climate like this, we don't have microorganisms that decompose the way they would on the East Coast or the West Coast. But by putting out all of those fires for 80 years, we created an unnaturally heavy fuel load that now occupies about 300 million acres in the West, or roughly three times the size of California. So that's number one, a part of the perfect storm. We've got this really, really heavy fuel load. But secondly, this is coming face-to-face now with climate change. Five of the hottest years on the planet have been since 2000, records set in 2014, 15, 16, three major drought periods. This is the look in the face of climate change. And according to the most recent study, human-caused climate change, and this is an interesting study by the University of Idaho and Columbia University, where they, when they tease out what were natural consequences, such as Pacific Ocean circulation patterns changing, when they pull out all the natural variables that change the climate, what's left with the human side of the equation has been such that they now estimate that since 1985, the number of acres burning in the West every year has doubled. It's a big deal.
Well, and you've mentioned, too, that it's almost increased by nearly 10 weeks since 1979. The length of the wildfire season has increased by 19%.
Yes, absolutely. Around the world, it's about 18%. And in North America, especially the northern Rockies, it's about 75 to 79 days longer.
A longer, hotter summer?
Yes. The snowpack is going off earlier because it's warmer. We don't get as much precipitation in the form of snow. That increases. Increases the front side of the fire season. And in the fall, the snow doesn't come as early or as plentiful. And so we have warmer, drier, windier days in the fall. And that's why we have that longer fire season.
When you use this description in your book, Life in the Land of Flames, and talk a lot about the anxious nature created by years of wildfire seasons, and you know how we've begun to watch the snowpack, see when the flowers are blooming, and even just the smoke in the air that's become such a natural part of our cycles here in the West.
It's true. It's a little disconcerting to those of us who love the West and love those beautiful but perfect short summers where we really do have the experience of getting out in all this beauty, and to have it covered with smoke is not pleasant. And this is going to be, I think, what many summers, most summers look like for many decades to come.
So in terms of a segue, many of listeners are from Montana and Wyoming and certainly will remember the fires of Yellowstone Park, which were probably one of the really big, big fires of the time.
Yes.
Is that true?
It is true. That's one of those big fires that do come along every once in a while, and they were very unusual for a while. But to put it in perspective, since 2000, we've had 10 seasons where we've had more than a dozen so-called megafires, and a megafire is 100,000 acres or more, which is an enormous fire. That didn't used to be the case in much of the 20th century, but 1988 is a bit of a watershed. And as a reaction to the 88 fires, that's when land managers started saying, we really need to let fires, when it's appropriate and when the weather conditions allow and now no structures are threatened, we need to let fires in remote areas burn to clean up some of that excessive fuel load.
Well, and I will say, Gary, you and John both do such a great job of capturing really efficiently and elegantly what we're experiencing in Montana and Wyoming. And John, I really enjoyed your book, and especially, too, when you talk about the 1988 wildfires, you know, that Yellowstone is this changing paradise that people really didn't quite understand until these fires came flailing through, where ecology plays out in such a way long before human existence or interaction, and how that kind of changed what we knew about how to work with fire in the parks.
Right. The 88 fires were such an anomaly at the time. The notion that, that such huge wildfires could overtake such a gigantic landscape was a surprise to people, and especially a surprise in Yellowstone, because the wider cultural interpretation of the park at the time was that it was a place that would never change, that you could show your grandchildren the same scenes that your grandparents had showed you. And suddenly for that for half the park to be burned was a shock to people. Ecologists had been saying that fire was an important part of natural processes, but that hadn't really sunk in with the wider public. And so 88 was a big shock that way.
So your new book, Wonder Landscape, Yellowstone National Park and the Evolution of American Cultural Icon, is more than just a nature book. It's really a cultural history of the park itself. But you point out it was about what people wanted and needed in our country. Can you address that?
Sure. And, you know, to be in the studio here with Gary, I've known him for 27 years, and he's written so many wonderful ecology books about Yellowstone. I didn't want to go there. That's his great territory. But what I realized was that there was also this history of why Yellowstone has been famous. What has Yellowstone meant to people on the East Coast or the West Coast? Why did it matter? And so I would go around asking people, why is Yellowstone famous? And they would look at me, well, duh, it's famous because... But then they would give different answers. It's famous because of the geysers, because of the bison or the grizzly bears or the ecosystem as a whole, the fact that it was the first national park. Or the ones who were honest would say, because I heard about it when I was 5 years old as the home of Yogi Bear.
Yes.
And after 88, it also became famous as the place of the wildfires. And so Yellowstone has changed in its meaning for the wider culture, and that was the story that I wanted to tell.
I love, too, John, how you really talk about how national parks embody the ideals of wild and public spaces and sort of stand for the best version of ourselves. You bring in, you know, images of the West, like with painter Thomas Moran and Ansel Adams and all of these very iconic images that have been created of this place that was, quote unquote, a geological freak show. I love when you mention that in your book.
It was set aside because these geysers were so unusual, and in a time in the late 1800s where people were focused on freak shows, we need to preserve that somehow. But it evolved and came to represent different things, the West in general as a sort of scrap of the frontier. But what was particularly interesting to me was the notion of Yellowstone as art. Thomas Moran, on that early expedition, some of his artwork helped establish Yellowstone as a national park. When Ansel Adams came to Yellowstone in the 1940s, he had a very different artistic vision of what Yellowstone was. And when the founders of Yogi Bear came to, actually they never came to Yellowstone, but their depiction of what Yellowstone meant to kids in the 50s was very different. And so where I had always thought of Yellowstone as a natural place, it really is also a cultural place, and that culture has been changing.
So the park was established in 1872, and the first national park. Gary and John, both of you, how has the idea of a national park evolved? I'm thinking about, you know, when the fires were burning in 88, it was like a personal story to Americans. I mean, it was their national park. How have we sort of embraced the idea of national parks?
Well, I think when the 1872 came along and Yellowstone was established, it was at the beginning of a period that was marked, as John writes so eloquently in Wonder Landscape, where there were preservationists and there were conservationists who actually saw the protection of resources as a fundamental economic bit of sound policy, so that we would have these resources so we could use to grow the country. I think we have definitely drifted more toward a preservation culture, at least as far as places like Yellowstone, and Yellowstone serves that idea well. One of the things, though, that's interesting to me is that John mentions these wonderful artists that through the 19th century rendered these magnificent paintings like Thomas Moran and Albert Bierstadt. You see, as those canvases evolve through the 1800s, the humans start to disappear to a large extent through the canvas. And in a sense, I think the Hudson River School artists increasingly thought that, you know, we don't really deserve, at least Anglos, don't really deserve to be in the wilderness. This is the garden as it looked before the fall, and we have fallen. That set up a discomfort level with us and the wilderness that still exists to this day. I don't think we're prone to seeing nature as including us as part of nature. And that's one of the fundamental problems we're facing right now. How do we reorient our lives in the face of things like climate change to really understand that humans are a part of the natural world?
And John, you brought that up very clear in discussing the artist and the pictures of the park, and then the pictures of the park with tiny little people in it, and the change from seeing nature without humans and then seeing us as a part of that.
Thomas Moran had little images of the explorers in his paintings to show how nature sort of overwhelmed them. And yet Ansel Adams had no people at all in his photographs to show how valuable nature was on its own. And so the meaning that we put into parks changes over time, just like the meaning we put into, say, statues. And so some of the discussions that we've had around the state and the country recently about should certain statues still stand for what they stood for when they were built. The wonderful thing about Yellowstone is that it's so rich and complicated that we can apply new meanings to it as we have new values in society.
I'll say that you both intertwine such a rich storytelling capacity with this wonderful historical data. Your books were both so different and equally fascinating. I was wondering if you might share a passage from your works. Gary, would you like to share first?
Sure. This is from the prologue of Land on Fire. Across my 35 years of writing about the natural and cultural history of the American West, logging nearly 250,000 miles of highway and some 30,000 miles of trail along the way, wildfire has been a common companion. I've seen its handiwork all around my longtime home in southern Montana, how it's driven new generations of aspen and lodgepole forests in the Beartooth Mountains and farther to the south in the outback of Yellowstone, the way it's cleaned and pruned the Douglas fir and Engelmann spruce forests. Flames at my back have sent me scurrying like a startled mouse out of the lonely folds of Hell's Canyon, while big burns have eaten beyond recognition some of the landscapes I roamed in my youth, slices of the Sawtooth Mountains of Idaho, the Wemenooch Wilderness of Colorado, the southern uplands of Utah. When I first came to the West as a young man in the late 1970s, wildfire was still seen largely as a destructive force, which of course at times it can still seem today. But across the decades, I've also come to know it as a powerful agent of healing, a mighty wand that wipes the land free of disease and insects and fallen timber to create a stage for healthy, altogether magnificent new flushes of life. By returning essential nutrients to the soil, fire allows a flush of grasses that can provide especially nutritious graze for elk and bison, not to mention food for dozens of species of ground foraging birds. At the same time, small mammals who feed on the seeds of those grasses tend to increase in number after a burn, in turn providing food for hawks, owls, coyotes, and the like. Lately, though, I've also been witness to this land changing, increasingly being wrung dry by severe episodes of drought. And as a consequence, wildfire is establishing itself as a far bigger, much more forceful presence than ever before. In many recent years, my neighbors and I have choked on smoke from burning forests, have turned our heads up to the August sky looking for rain until our necks hurt, and on several occasions have packed up a few precious belongings and evacuated our homes, hearts in our throats, in the face of advancing flames. Despite the hubris humans have so often brought to our relationships with the natural world, in the case of wildfire, once believing we could all but eliminate it, fire has proven awfully good at dealing blows to swagger.
Wow, that's wonderful. Thank you. Do you do book on tape? Because I could listen to you read all day long.
Thank you.
That was great.
And John, do you have something from your book, Wonder Landscape, which is sort of a nice companion to what burns and what lives and how we relate to nature?
Thanks so much for asking. I too will read something from the prologue. On a crisp, sunny morning after a spring snowstorm, I drove along an empty road that snaked through thick lodgepole pines. I came across a bison, quiet if obstinate, standing almost in the road. I stopped the car, killed the motor, stepped out. Keeping the car between me and potential danger, I snapped a photograph. The whir of the advancing film highlighted the surrounding silence. No noise of humans or their vehicles. Instead, the muffled drips of melting snow. I was so close to the bison that I could hear the air huffing out of its nostrils. I took a deep breath. I gazed at the animal. Then I glanced up and down the road to confirm that I was alone with one of the wonders of Yellowstone National Park. It was May 1, 1988, my first visit to Yellowstone, and like any first-time visitor, I wanted to understand this place. Why was Yellowstone famous? Why did so many people, including me, feel compelled to make this pilgrimage? The encounter with the bison pointed me toward one answer. Here one could find unique and incredible wildlife. Later that day, I walked the rim of the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone River with its extraordinary colors etched in snow. I also felt the whoosh of the Old Faithful geyser right on time. I heard the gurgle and smelled the sulfur of nearby hot pots. The answer to my question broadened. Here one could also find rare geological marvels. Combining wildlife and geology, Yellowstone stood for pure, rich nature. I knew this answer had to be incomplete. I'd spent less than a day in this landscape of 2 million acres. I hadn't read any books, watched only a quick introductory film at a visitor center. I missed several of the park's famous destinations, including the terraces at Mammoth Hot Springs, more geysers and thermal features at Norris and Midway, a waterfall at Tower, and views from atop Mount Washburn. Furthermore, I spent most of my time in the car rather than out in that natural world. But I was satisfied that I'd gotten a start. I didn't realize how that single day would expand to a 29-year quest. And then from later in the prologue, I started out wanting to understand the uniqueness of Yellowstone National Park. I pictured the moment I had shared with the huffing bison as special and impossible to duplicate in any other place. I thus imagined that moment as opening a door to somewhere different than the rest of America. But my quest ended up taking me to a place that's at the very heart of America. The story of Yellowstone is the story of what America wants from Yellowstone.
Wow. Thank you, John. Also, great reading voice. Very peaceful. I really was right there with you, like walking those terraces.
These guys aren't new to writing. They have been around. They have it down.
Yeah, but writing and reading, two totally different things. So thank you for sharing, you guys. It makes me wonder, I mean, what role fire and humans really play in this healthy ecosystem and the new realities of wildfire and of land management and yes, all of these things going on.
Well, as far as wildfire, it's hotter, it's bigger. This is the era of megafires, and that's going to be what we live with for some time, both, again, because of the excessive fuel loads, but also because of climate change. But what we can do to make it a little less painful for us is to start looking at what's called the wildland-urban interface, which is really where any home or structure comes right up against natural vegetation. 60% of the homes that have been built in this country since 2010 have been in the wildland-urban interface. There are too often very few governing agencies, including county commissioners, that insist on what are called firewise communities. And with a very few simple steps, we can actually have our homes close to nature without losing them. It's interesting that out of 70,000 communities in that wildland urban interface, only 3% now have taken any steps to make their communities fire safe. And just a quick anecdote to sum up, in the Black Forest fire of 2013 in Colorado Springs, in one part of that fire, 61 out of 67 homes were lost. Right next door in the Cathedral Pines subdivision, where some fire mediation techniques were taken. And these are very simple things, you know, creating a 5-foot apron around your house of non-flammable material and putting screens on the attic and the crawl space vents, things like that. In that subdivision, only 4 houses were lost. So we do have the ability to really make this era of megafire less painful, and it will require us to look again at our relationship with the natural world, accept that we're not going to dominate it, but that we can live with it in a much better fashion than we have.
Well, especially because you say in the book that it's growing at a rate of 3 acres per minute, this interface between humans and the natural environment?
Yes, about 1.5 million acres a year, and right now more than 80% of that wildland urban interface has yet to be developed. So this is just the beginning. We really do need to get serious. Again, not just about climate change, not just about cleaning up our mess from the 20th century of excessive fuel, but also about how we live with nature.
In light of all the floods and the hurricanes, I don't think Florida's learned any better than we have up in the mountains, have they?
No, it's a good point, Corby. Yes, that's right.
The distance that we can live with nature and then what protections we have to take if we choose to do that.
That's right. We are very long on hubris. We think ultimately we can and should control the natural world. I think there is a longing, though, to have a better way, a deeper connection, a more affiliative way of living on this world.
John, your book certainly talks about that, and that longing and what we want from nature and what we're willing to give up for it, too.
I am a storyteller, not a fortune teller, but as I look at the history of Yellowstone and try to look forward, it does seem that Yellowstone's meaning will certainly change. And one way that it could change would be to help humans come to terms with this new reality that Gary has described so well, living with fire in a landscape that is molded by fire. How is that going to look? Maybe we can practice and study and learn in Yellowstone.
Well, and Gary says in his book, fire doesn't suffer fools. It has no patience for stubbornness. And I thought that was such an excellent way to describe what we're all dealing with in this fire season.
Yes, if we don't do anything, fire will come knocking at our doors. The floods, the hurricanes will come overwhelming us. And so we do have a choice and an opportunity to get a little bit more real with how we live with nature.
So the national park system is moving into its second century, and I'm wondering how has the heritage of the parks, of our relationship with nature, shaped who we are as a people?
I think America has always been gifted with this wonderful natural landscape and natural resources, and that has shaped the strength of this country from the beginning. But those relationships have changed over time, and the once boundless frontier was conquered, and the remnants of it have been preserved in different ways and with different priorities. And I think the parks have been able to help people capture that and understand that.
Well, as John writes about so well, it reminds me of one of the very first so-called psychologists in the United States was a man named G. Stanley Hall. And he said two things are required for the proper raising of a child. One is story and the other is nature. And we keep coming back to that notion of nature over and over and over again. We claim it, we're proud of it, and we continue to need to redefine it. It's not, again, necessarily any more appropriate to say it's us and nature outside of us as something we protect as one protects in a zoo. It's how do we act as part of nature? Very much of who we are as human beings is the result of us having evolved as a part of nature. And to align ourselves with what nature can teach us, as John suggested earlier, is really the opportunity of the day.
And I think the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves can take place in national parks. And so that's the role that Yellowstone has served and can continue to serve as the setting for these stories that that help provide us with meaning.
So I would say to our listeners, if you want to know more about how we as Americans deal with nature, with our natural parks, with the natural existence of fire, these are two guys that you should read. Gary Ferguson's new book is Land on Fire, and John Clayton's book is Wonder Landscape, Yellowstone National Park, and the Evolution of an American Cultural Icon. Gentlemen, thank you for being in the studio.
Yes, thank you so much for being here and sharing your work with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having us. It's been really fun.
Anna, it was so great to have John Clayton and Gary Ferguson in the studio. I don't know if you know, but I met those gentlemen in the early 1990s when they were first starting their writing career and both lived in Red Lodge, and they read as a part of the writer's voice at the YMCA along with Anna Marble and a couple other Red Lodge writers.
How great that our writing community has remained connected all these years and are still sharing not only their love of writing, but yeah, that camaraderie that they really brought to the studio.
Did you say you also took a class from?
I did. John Clayton was the writer in residence up at MSUB, I believe, a couple semesters ago, and I audited one of his courses, and he really helped me get a book project in good shape. So it was nice to have that mentorship.
And I bet there are several writers in Montana that remember Gary Ferguson when he was one of our first writers community instructors for the writer's voice in maybe 1995. And he taught 12 weeks of workshop for a very small group of people. And he's not only a great writer, he's a great editor.
Ah, you know, and their books are going to be eligible for the High Plains Book Awards, not this coming awards season, but next year, correct?
Because these books were published this year, they'll be eligible for next year's High Plains Book Awards. This year, the High Plains Book Awards is October 20th and 21st in downtown Billings. You can see the full schedule of activities at highplainsbookawards.org. We'll have about 35 different writers from all over the region here doing readings and panel discussions.
Oh, what an exciting time in Billings.
Well, it also sort of, I think, addresses the fact that Montana and this region has a wealth of really good writers.
True. Very true. Well, looking forward to that, Corby. And yeah, glad to have both of those writers in the studio sharing their work with us.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.